Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. There are many ways in which climate change is beginning to have an effect on human activity and behavior. My guest today has been researching an often overlooked area that's already having an impact on human health. Dr. Richard Weber has been researching how climate change is affecting allergenic plants and how a longer growing season and more CO2 in the air will create more potent allergens, both today and in the future. He'll be giving the 8th Annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Plant Ecology 1 week from tonight at 7 p.m. at the Lorton Performance Center. Now, Dr. Weber's not a botanist. He's an allergist and immunologist at National Jewish Health in Denver, Colorado. He's a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado at Denver and a past president of the American College of Allergists, Asthma, and Immunology. But he's also had an avid interest in botany, and that's led to research on pollen allergies and hay fever plants. Aerobiology and the relationship between aeroallergens, that's allergens that are in the air, and the environment has also been an area of major interest. He'll be speaking on climate change and its impact on allergenic plants, again at the Meinig Recital Hall of the Lorton Performance Center, 1 week from tonight. That's Wednesday, April 19th at 7 o'clock. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Dr. Weber, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
You know, looking through your work, it looks like you've been researching and publishing on climate change's effects on allergens, at least going back 15 years and perhaps even further. What was the first thought of studying climate change's effects on allergens? What was the first impetus for doing that?
Well, since I've been in this area over the years, I've developed an interest in aerobiology in general, namely, you know, aerobiology is a big field, but when allergists talk about it, they're talking primarily about the allergenic plants and putting pollen and mold spores, up into the air. And when I first started in allergy, I never would have thought I would become an amateur botanist. But that's what happens as time goes by. And even here, you know, when somebody is in the same area for a long period of time, they think about, wait a minute. Now, we used to see ash pollen in April. What's happening now? We're seeing it in March. You know, and so it became obvious looking at our pollen counts, both the ones that we did here at National Jewish, and there are other a couple of other stations around town that also do counts, it became obvious that there was this drift and a shift in when you were seeing stuff. And it's actually been most dramatic in the early pollen, in the occurring early in the year, and which is primarily tree pollens. So we used to, you know, see occasionally, if it was a really mild winter, you might see some elm pollen showing up even in late January. But that was really pretty unusual. It was usually sometime in, there'd be a peak of a couple of weeks in the middle of February, you know. And then you'd start in March, you'd start seeing some cedar pollen, juniper pollen. And then in April is when you saw much of the other trees going, the ashes, there are some maples that pollinated in March, but most of them pollinated in April and that kind of stuff. But what we've seen, and it's been especially dramatic, I would say, over the past 3 or 4 years, is that more different pollens have been starting earlier. And so, for example, this year we saw very high levels of ash pollen in March, where you never used to see it in March. And in the cedar, has been persistently high. It's tended to have a very long season here anyway, mm-hmm. Usually starting up in March and then usually peaking out around Easter time, and then meandering off even into early May and sometimes even a little bit later. So it's always had a long season, but what we're seeing is higher counts and a much more robust beginning of the season. And that's what we've also been seeing with some of the other pollens. In this area, oak, the types of oak that grow in this general area, Front Range of Colorado, tend to be somewhat later pollinating. Now, that's not true everywhere. So, for example, down in Texas, I spent a few years in Austin, and we would get absolutely killed by the mountain cedar pollen, which usually started the week before Christmas, and would go like gangbusters through January and then meander off in February, but it was immediately followed by two robust months of oak pollen. You know, so up here in Colorado, different oaks and a much later season. But I've noticed even this year so far, so ordinarily when we used to see oak pollen primarily like later April into May, we've been seeing some oak pollen here now for, you know, for a good month. So it's not just one particular species of tree or variety of tree. You were seeing it, across the board with most of the common trees that grow here. And that's, you know, that, again, that's we see a lot of cedar, especially blowing off of the foothills. So what's called the predominant juniper in the foothills is Rocky Mountain cedar. So related, pretty closely related to the mountain cedar that's common down in, actually down in your area as well, you know, Texas and Oklahoma. And, you know, as far as the other things, we've not seen quite the same kind of increase in grass and weed pollens. Now that's because I think trees have long memories, and the amount of pollen that they will produce is also somewhat dependent on how much rain there was in the previous fall, and as well as how warm the winter is. But grasses and weeds are much more, I think, impacted by how much rainfall there is in the immediate preceding weeks. So if we have a rainy spring, then we see much more robust grass growth, and the same is true for later in the summer with the weeds. Now, having said that, if we jump across the ocean and look at what's been happening in Europe, there are also some very, very dramatic trends that have been occurring. Now, especially in the Mediterranean basin, parts of Spain and Italy and the like, they have their own variation of ragweed. It's called pilatory, and so it's the most common and kind of allergy obnoxious weed that they have. And what they've seen over the past 20 years is that the pilatory pollen season has expanded from about 3 or 4 months in the in the summer to now it's pollinating 10 months out of the year. And the counts have also been going up, and the Europeans have also demonstrated that the sensitization to these things has also increased. So there are more people suffering with allergy from this particular weed. But I'm happy also to say that that we're probably responsible for introducing ragweed into Europe. There's some rumor that it was actually first seen outside the Vienna airport after World War II, probably brought to Europe on the treads of Jeep tires or stuff. Who knows? But in any case, it's exploded through the Balkan states and has moved northward, and there they now consider it a major health hazard through much of Europe. and they're trying to decide what to do about the ragweed and how they can limit its growth and expansion. And there's been lots of articles written within the last year and a half, about what a health hazard this is and how the ragweed expansion through southern Europe up into northern Europe and even Scandinavia is expanding, driven and helped by climate change and what to do about it.
I was reading an article which sort of looked at CO2 levels and ragweed growth, and higher CO2 levels just cause ragweed to explode.
Yes, and now
we think of CO2 as mainly an atmospheric gas, but can it make that much difference on the landscape as well as far as CO2 levels?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, true, it's considered a greenhouse gas and contributing to, climate change or global warming because of its effect. But, of course, it's not the only greenhouse gas. Methane is another potent greenhouse gas, and even water vapor acts in that manner. But as far as the impact of CO2 on plants, it's been well, Siska and his colleagues have studied that exceedingly well. Also, some of the people out in Boston have done some studies, greenhouse studies, with growing ragweed and the impact of both increasing the temperature and increasing the CO2. And there's no question that ragweed especially loves CO2 and will grow much more robustly, produce larger plants, so more biomass, more pollen production, and possibly even that the pollen grains themselves have somewhat increased levels of the major allergen called AMBA1. So we have bigger plants, more pollen production. There is evidence for longer seasons as well, and that the individual pollen grains may even be a little more potent. So it's like a triple whammy.
Wow.
Siska again has had a nice paper that was published now about 5 years ago, where he was looking at what ragweed was doing in the more northern latitudes and showing that ragweed is very sensitive to frost. So a good killing frost really does ragweed in and pretty much ends the pollen season. And what they have shown was especially in the more northern latitudes of the upper Midwest into Canada, that the season has been increasing, and so the overall total pollen production has been increasing as well, and that's due almost entirely, they felt, to the fact that frosts were coming later and later with the increased global warming.
My guest today is Dr. Richard Weber. He's a research allergist and immunologist at the National Jewish Health and a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado at Denver. He's also the past president of the American College of Allergy, Asthma, and Immunology, and he'll be giving the 8th Annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Plant Ecology, because that's one of his areas of research, is learning about plant ecology to help predict allergy needs, and that will be taking place Wednesday, April 19th at the Lorton Performance Center on the TU campus. He's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Well, so what's the practical implication for an allergy sufferer? It's just longer seasons, or is it going to have a more profound effect on their overall health beyond just nuisance allergies? I suppose it assumes on how susceptible to an allergen they are.
Yes, I think that's true, but I'd like to respond to the nuisance comment. When talking about allergic rhinitis or hay fever, I used to call it the Rodney Dangerfield of medical diagnosis because it just didn't get any respect. And if you don't have it, you don't care. Somebody says, "Oh, I'm suffering with my allergies." Yeah, and people who don't have it, they'll say, oh, yeah, whatever. But there's actually been work showing that allergic rhinitis in your season has a bigger impact on your quality of life than even moderate asthma does. And so people can be really, truly miserable. And they've even shown that children in their hay fever season can develop sleep apnea, something we usually just associate with adults. And so these can indeed have big impacts about work productivity, how people feel in general, and that's also been shown that work productivity definitely takes a dive when people are suffering from their seasonal allergies. So although we kind of think maybe that it's a trivial disease, it really isn't. Mm-hmm. And it certainly appears to be affecting a larger proportion of the American population, and in which is true for actually all of the major big three, what we call atopic diseases, the allergic diseases, which are hay fever, allergic rhinitis, asthma, and atopic eczema. And all of those have been increasing in prevalence over the last 100 years. And one could wonder what all affects, why that has been. And people have honed in on, well, Western lifestyle, diet. Maybe we're too protective. We're immunizing our kids so they don't get the usual crud that they used to get. That kind of thing. But one thing that may also contribute is that we're being exposed to outdoor allergens in larger amounts because climate change appears to be impacting for many different allergenic plants on both the length of the pollen season and the peak of the season, how much pollen is actually produced. And so the exposures are going up, and maybe that has something to do with this.
Yeah, it sounds like these studies over the last 15 years are really aimed at seeing whether the pollen being produced is more robust and more potent, perhaps.
Yeah, and I think that is true, because you could argue that a plant maybe only produces so much of the allergic proteins, the allergenic proteins. And so maybe if there's more pollen produced, maybe it's diluted out because there's only so much to go around, and so maybe each grain has less allergenic protein in it. No, that doesn't appear to be the case. So the more pollen, the more allergenic protein, and so we are being exposed to larger amounts of the thing that actually drives the allergic rhinitis, or for that matter, allergic asthma.
What would be your best guess that we're becoming more susceptible to it, or we've always had that susceptibility, but just the amount of pollen is triggering our immune responses?
There is definitely something in the lifestyle that has something to do with this, but it's never really been cleanly worked out. And so is it lifestyle? No, I think that probably the biggest thing, but we don't know exactly what it is in the lifestyle. But is it exposure as well? Yeah, so I think it's exposure as well that's been increasing. But things are changing. We used to say that allergy is one of the few things that gets better as you get older. And so that it was much less common to see allergic rhinitis in older patients. Well, someone actually looked at that not so long ago. And so, for example, like 40 years ago, someone did a study looking at how common allergies were in young people and older people, and there was a pretty big spread between someone who was 20 and somebody who was 65 as far as the likelihood or the prevalence of allergy. Well, that study was repeated just a few years ago, and now all of a sudden the 20-year-olds still were more allergic, tended to be more allergic than the older people, but that difference in the prevalence had really shrunk. And so what's happening now, it is appears that people, as they age, are holding on to their allergies maybe a little bit longer. And we can't say like we used to, oh, yeah, it'll get better. You'll outgrow it as you hit senility, you know, or, that was badly worded.
Let's say that again?
As we become more mature, you know. So it looks like these things are persisting longer. So what that means is that we're going to see a general prevalence in the population that it continues to increase.
My guest today is Dr. Richard Weber, a research allergist and immunologist at National Jewish Health and a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado, Denver. He'll be giving the 8th annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Plant Ecology, looking at the climate change and its impact on allergenic plants. Well, from the implication of your work and other researchers, should allergy and asthma sufferers sort of prepare for more, in across the United States, of more of a 12-month exposure?
It may well be.
I would imagine certain parts of the country already have that.
Yes, and that's certainly true. So, for example, we've been talking a lot about ragweed, but if you look at grass pollen, so if you move from the northern states down south, the length of the grass pollen season kind of expands. And so whereas in the northern or the midwestern northern states, you may see a grass pollen season that is at best 2 months, in parts of southern California or southern Florida, grass pollen is going to be around for maybe 10 months out of the year. And I suspect that as we go along, just like the European experience with this pilatory, we're going to see the same thing, that we're going to see this broadening out of the seasons for a lot of different allergenic plants. And, we've been talking primarily, about ragweed and some of the trees, but this is also true for some of the late summer weeds. And, for example, here in Colorado and in the western states, there are a lot of related plants that are called sages or sagebrush,
right. Mm-hmm.
The genus is Artemisia, and there's more of them in the western states than the eastern states, but there's been work in Europe and actually in the Eurasian steppes where a good share of the ground cover is one of these Artemisias, and they've also shown throughout Europe that the season, there's more Artemisia or sage pollen, than there has been before. So we can expect that this is going to affect many different parts of the globe, not just here or there. So it's going to be a general problem. And whether that's been contributing again to the increased prevalence of allergic people, or whether it's only one factor of several, which I suspect is what the truth is, that it's going to be a bigger and bigger problem.
Now, years people used to move; they would migrate to a place. It used to be you moved to places like Denver or the high desert in Arizona to get away from allergens. Of course, that's been pretty thoroughly debunked. This is basically if you move there, you'll develop allergies to the things that you now live around.
That's right.
But
that's not all. And you just mentioned Phoenix, and there was now a number of years ago a phenomenal study looking at allergenic plants in Tucson. What they found was that when the older data, they had the usual, a few things that were more deserty kind of things. But what do people do? So people were told to move to Arizona for their health, right? The dry climate, et cetera. Well, what happens when you move from the Midwest to a dry climate like Arizona? You look around and you don't say, this desert is absolutely phenomenal. I just love the desert. They try to make it the Midwest. So they start planting mulberry trees. They start planting other things. They introduce all sorts of Midwestern plants, and of course then they have to water them. And so there's more water use. That's kind of a useless waste of water. But so what they showed in Tucson was all of a sudden all these Midwestern plants that had not been seen there at all were producing humongous amounts of pollen. And so people don't think it's human nature. You can't leave well enough alone.
Well, so getting back to this idea of not moving to help your allergies, I mean, given the fact that there's going to be longer growing seasons and longer pollen seasons, does it make sense maybe to move northward to get more relief?
Yeah, probably is you're going to have to move as far north as the tundra. So it's, you know, it'll be interesting to see what, you know, I suppose for a variety of different reasons, every so often people say, yeah, we ought to move to Canada. And we're not going to get into the...
Okay, go ahead.
But you'd say, yeah, so, you know, but what's going to happen is they're going to see the same creep. So the, you know, so you're going to have to probably go as far north as Thunder Bay or something like that, you know, to avoid that. But the other thing is that the northern aspects of Canada, what's the major vegetation? It's not grass and weeds anymore. It's trees, and it's primarily northern trees such as birch and alder. They're humongous pollen producers.
Yeah. So, and they're seeing greater CO2 effects, too, permafrost and everything else.
Yeah, and they're all going to be driven by that. Yeah. You know, so it's probably reasonable to say that there is probably no absolutely safe environment unless you decide to move into the biosphere or something down in Arizona. And even that's probably not safe either. So I guess we just have to live with it.
Well, we will look forward to your appearance here in Tulsa. Dr. Weber, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, my pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Richard Weber is a research allergist and an immunologist at National Jewish Health and a professor of medicine at the University of Colorado at Denver. He'll be giving the 8th annual Paul Buck Memorial Lecture in Plant Ecology on Climate Change and Its Impact on Allergenic Plants. That takes place 1 week from tonight, Wednesday, April 19th at 7 o'clock at the University of Tulsa's Lorton Performance Center. The lecture is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.